When I first studied media, I knew that I would have to go out many times, and there are some surprising things that may happen. Especially that here, in the Gaza Strip, there may suddenly happen bombing or breaking into the strip or something like that. I know that my work requires that I be ready any time.
No doubt the female journalist students in the Gaza Strip could get the respect and admiration of the society and its support in different ways. This includes families and other parts of society. For female journalists, their career is respected among society and is not similar to any other career.
This is a full-time job that requires time and effort. I use my time here to produce some dramas that embody the reality we live and some social series. These series may be comedies or patriotic.
Indicators of the situation in Gaza Strip are frightening. Unprecedented levels of poverty, unemployment, and dependence on aid have put so much pressure on Gazans.
I started my work about 8 years ago as a TV correspondent. As soon as I started, there has been a lot of difficulties, mainly the political situation. Working as a journalist in general, or a correspondent in particular, has its own difficulties. I'm a mother of four, and of course, coming to work, you always face the difficulties of coming to work, the threats everybody else here is facing, plus having to leave my children home alone. Well, it takes a lot of effort. I mean, I have to work extra hours sometimes, and my kids have to give in on a lot of things. I mean, I don't cook all the time, that's one thing, but they have gotten used to the lifestyle. Plus, our work is difficult when it's, you know, the season is hot, when there are war. Other times I have, you know, some easier times, but so it's give and take.
صعب على فتاة أن تقتحم مجال خصوصا في بلد ساخن.
It's hard for a woman to work in this field, especially in a country that lives many proceedings and a conservative society. The beginning was hard, but at the end I proved myself and succeeded. I have proven that what I'm doing is a patriotic duty. Practically, if I manage work and home together, I can be successful in both. However, managing both comes at the expense of losing my comfort and psychological relief and even sleep hours.
Photography is maybe one of the most difficult media arts. That's because a woman is carrying her camera and taking photos like what other male journalists do. She exerts efforts and tries to be the number one. Thus, the way society looks at this was harsh at the beginning. They didn't accept that. But we overcame that now, and they started facilitating the female journalist mission and providing support. Some people knew my name and missed me, especially during the clashes of East Jabalia, as I was the only female shooting there. They're contacting me on Facebook and asking me where my visit is. They also offer help in case I can't go there. At the beginning of my career, the first challenge was my father, brothers, and my husband inquiring about what I'm doing. I was able to prove myself and make them change their attitude. The pressure was big, that I was a mother and studying and working the same time. I had to manage these things without losing any of the three sides.
I was living in hard circumstances lately because I was doing my master's. That made me leave home for long hours, sometimes 12 hours. For sure, that affected me psychologically and physically. It also influenced my family, including my daughter and husband and my social life.
Luckily enough, I haven't faced any difficulties as a woman. I mean, Palestinians are used to women being always part of the life, the struggle. They have always been there, whether as political participants or working in all different fields. So I haven't faced any difficulties. I mean, the Palestinian society accepts the woman as part of it, so they even support us.
Nowadays, there is great development of the society's attitude to female journalist. It became the opposite, as they would help and excuse her when she's late for home. Of course, there are exceptions. However, essentially, a successful female journalist takes care of herself and takes the society's traditions into consideration. This way, she will be respected, as I experienced.
One of the tiring things is that I'm pregnant and about to deliver a baby. It's possible to have the delivery symptoms any moment, but I'm still working. Despite everything, I'm happy that I'm working in my field and serving my nation and society. It's a national duty I should do.
To be a journalist in Gaza, working under aggressions, pressure, bad situation, financial cases of a humanitarian crisis, gives you courage and a big power and strong points, beliefs, methods to do and achieve more and more and more. And this is very important for my job right now, to prove that you are strong to be here in this position.
My first experience in war covering was disastrous and sad because it was hard to see casualties and martyrs of your nation. However, it was a big challenge for me that I could prove myself in the field. Other journalists were helpful as I was moving with them in their vehicles. We used to move together whenever there was bombing or shelling to the location. I challenged myself to hold back my tears in front of the martyrs' families and the fragments of children's bodies. Similar things happened during the funeral of Al-Darju children. I fainted after trying to touch their dead bodies. As a mother, I was strongly affected, and then I got over it.
We experience exceptional circumstances in Gaza. Anytime Israeli forces may break into the strip or bomb it, we may have clashes with the army. So I need to be ready and present anytime, ready to leave home to work to cover the news. This requires effort and time of what I say for my family.
I have just graduated from university and I started working before that. I was working at more than one place. I was an announcer in addition to other things. Besides that, I was a student and had a life. Society is divided into categories according to people's attitude to a working woman in general, and a female journalist in particular. For example, some people are open-minded and respect female journalists because their job is tiring. They have enough of work pressure, are in front of the camera and under different kinds of pressure. Some other people have another viewpoint. A woman cannot appear on TV as an announcer in an Eastern conservative Arab society. She cannot get dressed in certain ways and cannot be on TV from the first place.
The Women's Affairs Center in the Gaza Strip is concerned with media. It has a unit for television production and documentary movies. Many young Palestinian women start their careers from this place. The center organizes media courses regularly to improve the skills of the trainees so that they become able to work in this field.
The Women's Affairs Center has started training since 1995. We started our own activities by a Canadian producer who trained a group of 15 girls. It was a year and a half of training and documentary production. However, we first renovated the center, implemented for the strategic planning, Then we started a 200-hour training course for some young women who wanted to learn production, shooting, and editing. Our first experience included 12 young women. Then the next year, the number increased to be 20. A year after, the applications were about 100. And we started holding entrance exams and other exams for the candidates. We would also select the best trainees and the ones we feel they would carry on in this field.
I chose to join the Women's Affairs Center by a recommendation of a friend. I was recommended to join it to grow the talent I already have, which is production and television. I went there and registered for training courses for a year and a half. Then, at the end of this year, a movie was produced, or it was a documentary that was done as a production experience.
Here is a group of young women who are being trained in many kinds of television skills, like voice, filming, lighting, and production.
We asked the center to hold these courses because we needed a staff for dramas in the movie. We wanted to know how to create drama in the movie, so it was not a regular shooting. It had to be professional.
I'm the camerawoman of drama and documentary films. I was the camerawoman of Notice and The Ways, two drama films. I'm also one of the editors of the film Where Are My Stuff?
From the first places, I grew up in a sports house and was brought up doing sports. My family was and is still supporting me. They are the ones who encouraged me in this field. This has made me more courageous and honest. My father, may Allah grant him health, is the one who advises me and discusses everything with me. My father and I are close friends, and I consult him about everything. He tells me what to do without being persistent.
Actually, my family is very proud of me. I worked on the movie Hope Remains a Title and won first place, and that was the first movie I won first place for in the Cinema and Art Production Festival. Since then, everyone started supporting me and telling me what to do. They gave me the choice to go anywhere.
There's a story for my journey. Leaving home to office means traveling from east the strip to the west. This path was a minefield for me. As soon as I reached my office, I went on air and reported news happening on my way there. There were cars bombed on my way and citizens killed. One time, Israel hit a market on the same road, Omar al-Mukhtar Street. So the way itself was a story for me. Leaving home and reaching office was martyrdom. Reaching office meant I had a new life. During the war, we didn't know the source of the shelling. There was shelling by tanks, planes, and boats. That was a really wild war, as the only people moving in streets were either fighters or journalists. Press men were bombed either by targeting their vehicles or their offices. We were targeted in Al Alam Channel or Media Group Company with a rocket during work. They didn't consider the existence of journalists in the place, though there were press signs like TV press. The targets were journalists who represent media, and they wanted to silence us. Personally speaking, that war was a media war. Massacres and the killing of the innocent was broadcasted live. I think that holding trials for Israeli leaders or issuing arresting warrants for them by some European courts was motivated by media records. There were warrants of arrest or deprivation of entering some countries. These courts depended on the testimony of journalists. Thus, Israel realized how dangerous a Palestinian journalist could be and what are they capable of to highlight the Palestinian cause and suffering. and also to show that war aims at killing the innocent and not ending the resistance, or terrorism, as they call it. The main goal was killing Palestinians. The bombing was random and shallow. They executed massacres, used white phosphorus, and burned people. No everyone was targeted in the strip, either directly or indirectly.
The Palestinian media is a part of the national Palestinian resistance. So everyone is engaged in those clashes. In every Palestinian confrontation during the past 50 years, journalists were in the front with people sacrificing their lives. They were a target of Israeli assassinations. Therefore, this is a historical evidence for the Palestinian media. Even during the last Israeli aggression on the Strip, a number of journalists were targeted and murdered.
I would say something my family may not like. I was destined to have a new life twice after the first and second wars on Gaza. If there's a third one, I will be a martyr. I keep wondering why I'm still alive up till now. I was facing death more than one time. It is the first time to come here after the war. Those memories are ugly, but at the same time, make us feel how strong we are. This place was bombed, and seconds later, we came here again. Some of us refused to get down. This makes me proud of the journalists of Gaza and Palestine, proud of the cameramen and work crews. We are really strong that a rocket was shelled here directly. We were standing here in this direction. We were shooting here with our cameras when the rocket fell here directly on this building. Of course, the destruction remains are still here of what happened in the war. Practically speaking, the moment I would leave home those days, leaving meant we were going towards death. However, when this place was hit by a drone rocket, we started waiting for the F-16 to come. Actually, we turned it into a joke between us and a good spirit. Guys, where would the rockets come from? This direction or that one? This plane or that one? After all, we wanted to work and convey our message. We were scared, but we controlled it and got over it. I would feel I'm on duty and asked to go out and tell the world about what happens and shoot everything to transform the suffering of my nation. If I didn't do this, a mother would lose her children and the child would lose her family with no one knowing about them. Another woman would suffer regardless of being a mother or a sister or a daughter. At the end, it's a duty. It's a testimony for every female journalist in Palestine and Gaza in particular. They are strong. We have unbelievable determination that words cannot express, but we lived that a second time during the Second War. I also confirm that we're going to live the same if there happens any aggression on Gaza. None of the female journalists would back away. We became stronger with more experience.
Isdra has worked in this field since she graduated from university. She was always in the thick of the action. She is known for showing humanitarian news features to the world. Isra has won the award for the best TV correspondent in the Islamic world.
It was something great. I didn't know about that contest. Those people were following up with our work and reports and collected works of hundreds of female reporters and journalists all over the world. At the end, they decided that I deserve the title of the best female reporter in war covering in the Muslim world. I felt it was the first reward after the war. Rewards are not necessarily money or tangible. The idea of having such a title meant that people were following up with what I was doing and appreciating that I was going to death itself for the sake of telling the world that there is a nation being killed and cleansed.
There's a nation witnessing the melting of its people by white phosphorus in front of them. I succeeded in delivering this message, and this was what made me happy the most after the war until now. I could deliver the message.
Lots of stories in Gaza, lots of telling stories in Gaza, and lots of people, lots of successful, lots of negative and positive, and sadness and happiness and tears and furs and lots of things that against life and come with life. It's our turn, it's our responsibility as journalists to work in all those and put it in one circle. And then they cannot say that, oh, because you're a woman, you're sexist in this. No, because I am a refugee Palestinian. I know how to speak in my issue and how to present my own issue. This is my issue. This is my homeland.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
It is now history, in fact, glorious history, how the U.S. continued to fail in its devilish designs, how its agents, the MKO hypocrites, have suffered humiliation after humiliation as terroristic traitors, and how Saddam eventually vanished from the scene in utter disgrace. While today, the power and prestige of the Islamic Republic of Iran is paramount all over the region and beyond, including amongst our Iraqi brethren with whom Washington had tried to create bad blood, says Kayhan, international staff writer, in an article published under the heading, How the U.S. Continued to Fail in Its Devilish Designs. Stay tuned for more. On the 7th of the Iranian month of Tir, corresponding with June 28, Iran commemorated the 41st martyrdom anniversary of Chief Justice Ayatollah Sayyid Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti, whom the U.S. had assassinated through its agents in Tehran, along with 72 revolutionary figures, including cabinet ministers and members of parliament, in a vain bid to overthrow the Islamic Republic in the midst of the devastating war that the American stooge Saddam of the repressive Ba'ath minority regime of Baghdad had imposed as part of the same nefarious goal. It is now history, in fact, glorious history, how the U.S. continued to fail in its devilish designs, how its agents, the MKO hypocrites, have suffered humiliation after humiliation as terroristic traitors. and how Saddam eventually vanished from the scene in utter disgrace, while today the power and prestige of the Islamic Republic of Iran is paramount all over the region and beyond, including amongst our Iraqi brethren with whom Washington had tried to create bad blood. The keys to the chain of success of Islamic Iran, which over the past four decades has achieved self-sufficiency in all fields, including medicine, aerospace, nanotechnology, the nuclear fuel cycle for peaceful progress, the cyber world, artificial intelligence, and military industries, are indeed the spirit of resistance and the courage to court martyrdom for safeguarding of humanitarian principles. It is obvious that a cowardly satanic regime like that of the U.S. cannot defeat the godly values which Iran espouses for the promotion of peace, stability, and a region fearlessly resisting imperialism, terrorism, Zionism, and all hegemonic plots. This is fully evident today throughout the neighborhood where in Syria the people and the government stand tall after years of resistance to defeat the macabrely murderous terrorists of various hues and colors unleashed by the U.S., the illegal Zionist entity, reactionary Arab regimes, and Turkey in a vain attempt to balkanize that country. In Iraq, which used to be the bastion of brutality of the despicable Ba'athist, it is people's will at the ballot boxes, under guidance of the religious leaders and in harmony with the patriotic popular mobilization forces that governs the country, even though the remnants of the U.S. occupiers who precariously cling to a few illegal military bases despite the verdict of the parliament for their exit are trying to prevent formation of a broad-based government. In Lebanon, the resistance forces led by the legendary anti-terrorism movement, the Hezbollah, have again emerged as the largest single group in the recent elections to ensure establishment of yet another independent government in a further blow to the divisive forces backed by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. In occupied Palestine, the Israeli usurpers, in spite of their inhuman atrocities against the sons of the soil, are clearly living on borrowed time and might implode any moment as the clocks tick fast for the day of destiny, thanks to the indomitable spirit of resistance of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and other patriotic groups. In Yemen, the popular Ansarullah movement heads the legitimate government in Sana'a with firm faith in God Almighty and confident of the people's resistance that safeguards the independence of the greater part of the country in the face of the savagery of the U.S.-backed Saudi and Emirati invaders whose unmanly acts of state terrorism have been countered with a steady barrage of indigenously built ballistic missiles and drones, not on civilian centers, but on military industrial installations. In Bahrain, the repressive Al Khalifa regime of pirate origin is at its wits' end, and no matter how humiliatingly it clings to the aprons of the U.S. fleet and how humbly it licks the boots of the Zionists, it cannot delay for long the democratic aspirations of the Bahraini people based on Islamic resistance. We'll be right back. In short, throughout the region, client regimes are facing simmering resistant revolutionary forces which will soon emerge to root out U.S. hegemony, which is on the way out in Pakistan and even in Turkey. As for Afghanistan, 40 years ago, the country was under occupation of the Soviet Union, which has long disintegrated, while the U.S. occupation that followed also recently ended after two disastrous decades, all of which is proof of the fact that Americanism has miserably failed. Thus, it was not for no reason that in 1981, following the June 28 dastardly blast in Tehran, the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, had hailed as a nation unto our nation, Martyr Beheshti, whose immortal words continue to ring in our ears. O U.S., be angry with us and perish in this state of anger.
Hidden Files. Have you heard about the billionaire space race? What about Harvey Weinstein's abuse case? Or the Trump supporters' takeover of the U.S. Capitol? Well, chances are that you have. When it comes to major stories from mainstream media, the world is certainly a small place where the news is heard loud and clear. But in the cacophony of these major stories, there are many voices that are hushed. Stories that seem as small as a single ordinary person and yet are as large as a community, a major city, or even a nation. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzieh Hashimi, and today, in this new program, I'd like to take a pledge to provide you with a rare glimpse of news that seldom make the news, or stories that don't fit the mainstream plot, and of voices that are silent. But before we go further, let me tell you a personal story that doesn't only belong to me, one in which, had things gone differently, I would likely not be here with you today, and neither, perhaps, with the idea of this program, a story that started some 3 years ago with my arrest in the U.S.
It's just past 7:30 in the morning over here in the Iranian capital. You're going to have to begin this bulletin with a shocking development. Press TV's news anchor, Marzieh Hashimi, has been detained and imprisoned in the United States with no formal charges. Ms. Hashimi was arrested in a St. Louis airport and has now been transferred to a Washington, D.C. facility by the FBI. The reason for her arrest, as I just said, remains unclear up to this moment. She was visiting the United States to visit her ill brother, who was terminally ill, I've been hearing, and, of course, visiting her other relatives. Ms. Hashimi has informed her family members of her ill treatment in detention. Hashemi, a Muslim woman, was born in the United States and is an American citizen.
Such stories of being kidnapped and arrested without charge are so surreal that it's hard to believe that it can happen to you. Until, of course, it does. Growing up as a black American, studying journalism as a student and later as a convert to Islam, I heard and read this happened to many others, of course, but I never thought that I myself could end up being kidnapped and arrested. And that's exactly the point. The numbers speak for themselves.
Mass incarceration in the United States definitely has a racial component to it. According to the United States Sentencing Commission, black male offenders receive sentences on average 19.1% longer than similarly situated white male offenders. In addition, black men are 6 times more likely to be incarcerated than white men. Following is the lifetime likelihood of imprisonment for U.S. residents born in 2001.
With me understanding well the history of policing and the judicial system in the United States, when I was arrested, I knew that anything could happen to me. I knew that there were political prisoners in the country who were still incarcerated after 40 years and had spent most of those years in solitary confinement. Though the United States denies having any political prisoners, I knew how people had been framed for so many offenses. Now, my case was quite unique in another aspect. That is, unlike the many black men, Muslims, and activists, I had a decent following as a media personality here at Press TV. So the station kicked off an awesome information campaign about what was happening, and social media groups went into full gear getting the word out. I didn't know about all this from the inside of prison, of course, but I did see that my treatment was quickly improved, and then in a matter of days, I was released without charge. But I don't know of anyone else who has been this blessed. It's not uncommon for black men, for Muslims, and for activists to spend years in prison, at times in solitary confinement, without there being a shred of honest evidence against them. Many end up pleading guilty as they are not told that they will not be released unless they plea bargain and spend some years in prison. So it's only fair for me to use this platform to speak about those whose cases haven't received this kind of public attention, like fellow Americans whose country claims to be the vanguard of protecting human rights around the world, when in actuality it often falls quite short of defending human rights even according to its own constitution. Well, I'd like to bring in my special guest for this program. Welcome, Dr. Cynthia McKinney to Hidden Files.
Dr. Cynthia McKinney. As a member of the Democratic Party, Dr. McKinney served 6 terms in the U.S. House of Representatives starting from 1993. McKinney left the Democratic Party and ran in 2008 as the presidential candidate of the Green Party of the United States. She is a major critic of U.S. policy as it is related to Israel and was part of a Gaza relief boat to help to get basic supplies to the Palestinian people of Gaza. The boat was attacked by the Israeli Navy. McKinney introduced legislation to have the government release information about the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. She has also introduced legislation demanding the release of government information regarding the murder of Tupac Shakur.
Thanks so much for being with us. It's a pleasure having you. Well, I'd like to start off in looking at the situation. I mean, it was amazing what happened to me and the way it went down, Cynthia. And it appears what we're seeing is the erosion of the Constitution. Your thoughts about this and how exactly is this happening? What's going on?
Well, I think what has happened in the United States is that over the years, we've had a gradual shifting in even the kind of governance system that exists inside the United States. So there was a time when the Constitution was the primary law of the land, and people spoke about constitutionalism. The Bill of Rights was something that rolled off the tongues of everyone, and if a law or a particular behavior was unconstitutional, it was challenged. But gradually what happened is that we saw the erosion of not just, of constitutionalism and of the Bill of Rights itself. And so a situation like what happened to you, which is unconscionable in a country that prides itself on freedom and due process and justice, but now no one's rights are guaranteed. And so you've got people who went to the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, and they are in solitary confinement. Many of them have been in solitary confinement for months now. And the situation has changed. I believe what has happened is that there has been a coup against the U.S. Constitution. And the average, ordinary U.S. citizen doesn't realize that the constitutional protections that have been guaranteed for centuries really are no longer protecting the people of the United States. And the average, ordinary U.S. citizen doesn't realize that the constitutional protections that have been guaranteed for centuries really are no longer protecting the people of the United States.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting what you said. I mean, your thoughts overall on the role of the mainstream media in misinforming people about that reality of constitutional law and the basic rights that Americans once had, but they no longer do.
We used to have media. Well, actually, there was a time when we had real media. And even though that media had its own sort of vested interest or special interest in and of itself, you could at least get half of the story from U.S. Media. It's Walter Cronkite, and that's the end of the story. Or you'd have the other fella on radio, and he'd say, and now the rest of the story. So there was always a way to dig a little bit deeper, and we had investigative journalists who were given the opportunity to hone their craft with the problems around governance. So you even had, say, for example, the Washington Post with Watergate. It was the Washington Post that broke the story.
Right.
Now the Washington Post covers up because it's been purchased sort of indirectly by the CIA by way of Jeff Bezos and a $600 million contract for various things that Bezos was able to get by way of Amazon. So you've got a situation now where we don't even have alternative, we don't have responsible corporate media, we don't have alternative media, because now the foundations have stepped in, and you've got George Soros, who's pouring money into the Democratic Party, pouring money into alternative media. You've got already the other foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation and other foundations, pouring money into alternative media. So what used to be that, or what used to provide that critical analysis of what actually is happening in our political system and who is benefiting and who is losing, you don't have those questions even asked any longer. And so therefore, we've also had a situation where the courts in the United States have said that it's okay for the media to knowingly lie to its consuming audience. So now you've got legalized lying, you've got an end of investigative journalists, you've got the concentration of ownership of the media, both alternative and sort of corporate. And so now, basically, I think it was Mark Twain who said, even back then, he said that, you know, the more education you have, if you get your information from the regular media, then you're misinformed. Well, yeah, you're misinformed, and vast numbers of people in the United States are misinformed because they get their media from what they think are trusted sources, but they're no longer trusted.
What's your perspective on the internet being controlled and how that can affect people who are actually searching for the truth?
The shame of it all is that the internet itself and the research and development that gave us quote unquote social media was paid for by U.S. taxpayers. For these should be, as are the airwaves for that matter, should be public resources. But there's very little public in the public resources that have been privatized. Well, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said we need a revolution of values. And I would agree with that, talking about the United States. I would just say that we need a revolution, and that would probably end it full stop. I would end it full stop. We need to do away with everything that we know because it took a turn. And the turn that it took has been to the detriment of the people. It has been to the detriment of truth. It has been to the detriment of justice. It has been to the detriment of peace. We haven't had peace since I was an adult. And now I'm entering my senior years, and we still don't have peace. And in large measure, it's because of the belligerent policies of the United States of America. So we need to build new institutions, and they can exist alongside the current ones, but eventually we've got to get rid of the current institutions that no longer work for the people and no longer represent what they are supposed to be.
Well, when we look at the situation, I mean, Cynthia, both of us are American and neither one of us are living in the United States because of various reasons now. But when we look at this situation, the increase of censorship and pressure as far as the taking away of being able to have freedom of speech, I mean, what's happening? Where are we going with this?
Unfortunately, and there's so many more who are laboring inside the United States in jobs that they don't like, jobs that don't respect them, jobs just in order to make ends meet. And they, you know, for example, you have, I guess I shouldn't name, but I have followed many of the professors who are inside the United States, and they've been punished because of their belief system. And one of them is a Palestinian American who had a job offered to him, and then the job was snatched away from him when he put something on Twitter, and it's a shame. We have another professor who wrote a very internationally acclaimed book. That book was about the Holocaust, and he told me, Cynthia, I haven't worked since then. And that's probably been about 10 years ago, 10 or maybe 15 years ago now. So people are being punished. People are suffering in their own ways because the diminution of rights and the Bill of Rights is not a document that is living and breathing in the United States any longer.
Where do you see all this going? I mean, what has to happen in your perspective?
Well, you know, it, and people outside sort of look at you askance when you say, well, you know, I'm much more comfortable outside of the U.S. than I am inside the U.S. And people don't like outside because the United States is something, it's a dream. It's something to be aspired to. To live inside the United States. Every child's goal in life in certain countries is to be able to get a job in the United States, to be culled by the great culling machine and then leave one's country in the brain drain and go and help make private organizations like Google and Facebook more wealthy than they already are. The world has been turned upside down. Our values have been turned upside down, and the system is rigged, and it's rigged internationally as well. That's not just a inside the United States kind of thing. It's been rigged for hundreds of years. How do we unrig ourselves? I was at an anti-war protest, and I ended my speech by saying, "We shall take our country back." And then I thought about it for a while, and I said, I've been participating in anti-war speeches for 20 years, and we still haven't taken our country back, and we haven't ended the wars. After that last anti-war speech with the anti-war crowd that I was with, those are my people. And I thought about it, and I said, you know, I've been protesting for 20 years. I've been saying we're going to take for 20 years, and it hasn't happened yet. So what's the missing ingredient? When Trump said that the system is rigged, it was right. It was accurate. It was an accurate statement of that people in the U.S. find with their governance system now. What was left out of that analysis, though, was what has happened to the people since. I believe that for hundreds of years, as the system was being rigged, the people of the United States adjusted to the rigging of the system, and so they adjusted themselves. They themselves became rigged along with the rigged system. The only way we can actually have values that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. talked about is that we've got to unrig ourselves. We've got to dig deeply within ourselves and understand who we are, where we are, what our country has lost, and how we can get it back. Finally, the other thing is that not only in this sort of rigging and unrigging, the United States has never dealt with some issues like the race issue. And race is easily used. It's the kindling that is always there, that all one has to do is throw a match that has been, but it still has a little spark. And that spark is enough to just combust the entirety of the United States. That is something that has to stop. And if it doesn't stop, we will never unrig ourselves, and we will never have the revolution of values that we need, and we will never take our country back.
Well, Dr. Cynthia McKinney, thank you so much for being with me. It has been a pleasure speaking to you here, Hidden Files. The way the alternative media led this fight for my freedom and the way that on social media, hashtag Free Marzia Hashemi went viral were very effective campaigns and say a lot about the potential for alternative voices to play a bigger role in highlighting what is really taking place on the ground globally. Well, let's take a look at some of the actions held around the world during the Free Marzia Hashemi campaign.
Free, free Marzia!
Free, free Marzia!
Free Marzia Hashemi!
Free Marzia Hashemi!
Free, free Marzia!
Free, free Marzia!
Marzia Hashemi should be free!
Marzia Hashemi should be free!
She's African American. She's a woman. She's a Muslim. She has a conscience. She is intelligent. She is a journalist, and she is exposing America's dirty laundry.
Whether it's Trayvon Martin, whether it's Eric Garner, whether it's the people being starved to death in Yemen, or people being bombed in Pakistan, or people being killed in Gaza, or people being killed in Libya, Marcier's concern for humanity is that we live in peace.
Just because it's legal doesn't mean it's moral. Just because it's legal doesn't mean it's right. Just because it's legal doesn't mean it's just.
Free, free Hashemi!
Free, free Hashemi!
Free, free Hashemi!
Free, free Hashemi!
Up in arms on the streets of Tehran, anger today over the detention of a prominent journalist. Marzia Hashemi is an anchor for Iran's English language state broadcaster, Press TV, and she's American.
It's a mixed bag.
Christened Melanie Franklin, born in New Orleans to Protestant parents. And inspired by the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Hashemi converted to Islam and changed her name. Her colleagues are demanding her return. Hashemi's boss says she's been mistreated while in custody and has done no wrong.
This is not an acceptable reason to make Marzia as a political pawn in a political play, in a political war with Iran.
What my experience has shown me is that we can and must try to magnify the voice of the voiceless, and we can be effective. We have to dig into files that others don't want to touch, cases that have been ignored because it just wasn't in their interest to portray. And this program is a start. Here, together, we can inspect, inform, and ignite the change that needs to take place so that more stories can have a happy ending like mine, so that people like you and me can have a chance at living a life as a person and not be reduced to yet another statistic, another number. God willing, we will be back with another episode of Hidden Files next week with another story from another corner of this vast world of ours that has so much more going on than the titles from the mainstream media. Stay curious.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
taxing the excess profits of large corporations within the G7 alone could raise an estimated $430 billion to fight world hunger, deliver vaccine to entire world, and make a giant dent in the fight to drive down fossil fuel pollution and jumpstart the necessary renewable energy transition. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by John Quayle, journalist. This article is published under the heading Global Windfall Profit Tax of 90% Needed to Address Catastrophic Food and Climate Crises, Oxfam says. Stay tuned for more. With G7 leaders meeting in Germany for their annual summit,